Well, good afternoon. My name is Holmes Adams, and I have the pleasure, and I mean the distinct pleasure, of being chairman of the board of the Eudora Welty Foundation. And on behalf of the board and our national advisory board, we welcome all of you this afternoon to the Welty Garden and to hear our marvelous speaker this afternoon. I didn't start reading her books until about 2 months ago. And I bought so many of them at Muriel that when Mary Alice went to get her copy, they said, well, you know, some older man came through and he bought out the entire shelf. And so I am delighted to have her here today. The Welty Foundation's primary purpose is to preserve the literary legacy of Eudora Welty. So we have a very simple mission. But it has many facets, one of which is that we work hand in glove with the Department of Archives and History, helping to support this house, the garden, and also the collections at Archives and History. And in addition, we have the Eudora Welty Lecture in Washington, D.C. every fall, and we are delighted to underwrite today the Betty Jolly Lecture. And we have His Honor Grady Jolly here with us. Thank you very much, Grady, for doing this. And with that, I want to turn it over to Suzanne Mars, who is in charge of the program today. Suzanne? I don't think Suzanne needs an introduction.
Well, I'm a has-been. Retired Millsaps faculty member, but I'm still working as scholar in residence here at the Welty House. I'm glad they've kept me on, and I'm delighted to welcome you to the 4th annual Betty Jolly Lecture. I'd like to thank the Welty House and Garden for hosting us. Their staff has been working very hard today. And I'd also like to thank the Mississippi Department of Archives and History for providing advertisements for today's events. And we are also very grateful that the Millsaps English Department Visiting Writer Series, directed by Professor Michael Pickard, has joined the Welty Foundation in sponsoring this event. The Jolly Lecture has become an important part of a Welty Foundation Millsaps College partnership, and I'm glad that partnership is flourishing. In 2008, I had the opportunity to teach a Millsaps Great Topics seminar called Eudora Welty and Friends. The remarkable group of students in that class and I so much enjoyed discussing works by Welty and her friends that we decided to keep meeting as a book club. Our club members are, and most of them are here, Martha Blunt, Lynn Evans, Susan Shands Jones, Linda Lane, Judy Parker, Sister Simmons, Julianne Summerford, Catherine Wiener, and Becky Youngblood. This membership list, alas, is incomplete. Our friend and fellow reader, Betty Jolly, died 4 years ago. Betty's husband, Grady, and her niece, Anna Burnett, are here with us today, and I'd like for them to stand and be acknowledged. Thank you. As Grady and Anna know, Betty was the guiding light of our club. We loved her, and we can't replace her, but we can pay homage to her. Those of us in Betty's club hope the lecture series named for her will encourage the appreciation and study of serious literature. With that goal in mind, we have established and raised funds for an endowment that will sustain the series here at the Welty House, where Betty was an outstanding docent. Many of you, including Judge Jolly, his former law clerks, and members of the Belhaven House and Garden Club, have contributed generously to the endowment. We thank you for this support, and we ask for your help in ongoing fundraising efforts. This afternoon, we are deeply honored, as Betty would be, to have Alice McDermott as our speaker. Alice was born in Brooklyn, grew up on Long Island, and did her undergraduate degree in English at the State University of New York in Oswego, where I was at that time a member of the faculty and was fortunate to call Alice my student. I have ever since been so grateful that I gave Alice A's in my classes. I don't have to face that humiliation. After graduating from Oswego in 1975, Alice completed an MFA at the University of New Hampshire, and in 1982 published her first novel, A Bigamous Daughter, which was enthusiastically welcomed by reviewers. Since that time, she has published a series of distinguished and complex and compelling novels. That Night, 1987, At Weddings and Wakes, 1992, Charming Billy, 1998, Child of My Heart, 2002, After This, 2006, Someone, 2013, and The Ninth Hour, just last year. One of these novels, Charming Billy, garnered a National Book Award, and three were finalists for the Pulitzer Prize. Alice's most recent novel, The Ninth Hour, has been acclaimed as one of 2017's best novels and is a finalist for the National Book Critics Circle Award to be presented next week. Alice, to me, seems to build on the tradition of writing exemplified by Eudora Welty. Like Welty, Alice possesses a love for words upon words and for the beautiful accretion of a sentence. Those are Eudora's words, of course. And like Welty's fiction, Alice's demonstrates that all the opposites on earth are close together, love close to hate, living to dying, but that of them all, hope and despair are the closest blood, unrecognizable one from the other sometimes, making moments double upon themselves, and in the doubling, double again, amending but never taking back. If you haven't read The Golden Apples, read it and find those words in its pages. How fortunate the students at Johns Hopkins University are to have Alice McDermott as their Richard A. Maxey Professor for Distinguished Teaching in the Humanities. And how fortunate we are to have Alice here to read from The Ninth Hour, a book the Washington Post has quite rightly called superb and masterful. Please welcome Alice McDermott.
Oh, thank you so much, Suzanne. Thank you all for being here. Thank you to Betty Jolly for allowing us all to gather like this. How wonderful to honor a friend and a member of a book club, even more important, in this way. This has been such a delightful day for me. It's really been a pilgrimage in many ways. Eudora Welty has meant so much to me as a writer, as a woman who writes, and she was very much with me, I think, as I was composing The Ninth Hour. And just to, not to give anything away, to echo some really important words. Eudora gave me the word confluence as a writer, as a teacher of writing, and it's always fascinated me from the first time I discovered it at the end of One Writer's Beginning. And that idea of confluence of time and generation very much guided my hand when I was writing The Ninth Hour. So it's just such a thrill and a delight and a confluence of many things, starting back in Oswego when Suzanne was my professor, to stand here today. So I just want to begin with a few of Eudora's words that I'm sure are quite familiar to all of you. Through learning at my later date, things I hadn't known, or had escaped or possibly feared realizing about my parents and myself, I glimpse our whole family life as if it were freed of that clock time which spaces us apart so inhibitingly, divides young and old, keeps our living through the same experiences at separate distances. It is our inward journey that leads us through time, forward or back, seldom in a straight line, most often spiraling. Each of us is moving, changing with respect to others. As we discover, we remember. Remembering, we discover. And most intensely do we experience this when our separate journeys converge. Our living experience at those meeting points is one of the charged, dramatic fields of fiction. I'm prepared now to use the wonderful word confluence, which of itself exists as a reality and a symbol in one. It is the only kind of symbol that for me as a writer has any weight, testifying to the pattern, one of the chief patterns of human experience. Of course, the greatest confluence of all is that which makes up the human memory. When I began The Ninth Hour, and you know, every novel has its own genesis. I think every novel has a unique and separate subject until I publish it, and then people say to me, oh, Irish Catholics again. but I do know that each novel has a separate beginning. And this novel began with a conversation I had with a lawyer friend. It was not a Southern lawyer. He was a upstate New York lawyer who ended up in D.C. And just, you know, after dinner, second or third bottle of wine, in this conversation, he brought up that he had a vague memory in the town where he grew up, which was about around Watertown, New York, of an old man who lived in one of his great aunt's houses who had been a substitute in the Civil War for one of his great uncles. And, you know, as conversations go, this was something interesting. I didn't know that about Terry, but it stayed with me. And I found myself growing more and more interested in this idea of substitutes. I knew it historically. I knew it had happened. I suppose I read about it in history class. Some years back, I read a wonderful novel about the draft riots during the Civil War in New York City, a novel by Peter Quinn called Banished Children of Eve. And there had been some mention then about substitutes. And I found myself just reading about it and how it worked and how it was codified and who was a substitute. Often it would be immigrants, sometimes convicts who were trying to escape into the army and disappear into someone else's life. Often the substitutes were paid for by wealthier families in order to keep a beloved son out of the war. I know this happened both in the North and the South. And since I'm not a historical writer, and I never think of myself as a historical novelist, I found myself moving towards my fascination with this idea of substitute, one who takes the place of another so that the other might live and thrive. I started thinking of it as a very interesting metaphor, the idea of one life substituting for another, one person putting themselves in harm's way for another. It brought me to ideas of selflessness. What do we think of selflessness in the 21st century? Do we really respect it? Do we even understand it? One who gives up a life so that another may live. I've been teaching long enough, and I'm sure many of you who have been in the classroom have this experience, that I have wonderful young students come in and tell me how, after they graduate, they're going to join the Peace Corps or do Teach for America, or they're going to go to Habitat for Humanity and build homes, or they're going to go down to the Caribbean and they're going to work on social issues. And inevitably, when they tell me these wonderful, wonderful goals that they have and these selfless things that they want to do is when they get out of college, and inevitably, at some point in the conversation, they'll say, and it will look really good on my resume. And I've often toyed with the idea of, wouldn't it be purer if you went and did this and never told anybody that you did it? You know, and then I know their parents would be calling me up if I said, you know, why don't you just leave it off your resume? Just do it for the sake of the people you're helping. Don't do it also for credit to yourself. But of course, in the 21st century, we'd say, that's nuts. They're nice people. They're helping. Let them get credit. So I started thinking about all these ideas of selflessness, selfishness, one life for another. And of course, you can't be raised as a Christian and not think of one life given up so that all might live. And then I thought, well, I'm back to another Catholic novel. No getting around that. But this idea of confluence and what Eudora talks about, generations through time, and how we live separately from each other, but fiction can bring us back. And in very many ways, that notion, as I began to think about how I could tell a story that would feature this idea of a substitute, of selflessness, and how I could in some way get the story to be significant through various generations, brought me to understand that I could not tell a chronological story and that I would have to find a narrative voice that could look through time. And that very important aspect that haunts all of Eudora's work and has inspired me in so much of mine about memory and its importance and how it's essential it is, not just to storytelling, but to what we make of our lives. So I created a substitute, a story about a family that has a substitute in it, something like the substitute that my friend first mentioned, a man who has taken the place of a great-grandfather and was not killed in the war but came back without a leg and without an arm and without half his hearing, and showed up at the family's house to say, I substituted, I took the place of your son, he is whole, he is living, he will go on to have children generation after generation, but now you have to take care of me. Now I'm here. And I thought, okay, so who takes care of him? And one of the really interesting things that I thought, the notion of selflessness and selfishness and the idea of a substitute is, how long must we stay grateful to the person who has put himself in harm's way? One generation, two generations? When do you look back and say, I know I'm alive because that person 300 years ago did that, but you know, I can't be thanking him. I just have to go and live my life. So it's that aspect of generation after generation, of gratitude, the realization that our lives are made possible by someone who has served as substitute, and yet maybe we can't think about that all the time. This confluence of this historical fact of substitutes in the Civil War, of family and generation after generation, and my own DNA as an Irish Catholic, brought to the story a group of women who served as substitutes, who gave of themselves so that others might live. So I'm just going to read two short sections of the novel that take these two aspects, and I hope maybe you'll get some idea of how Eudora's sense of confluence has guided my hand. This is from a chapter about a third of the way through, called Rose. We had on our father's side a great-great-aunt, Aunt Rose, a tiny woman, very old. We recall a velvet hat and a pale broadcloth suit, rose-colored perhaps, and maybe the smell of rose water about her as she made her way into the house. one gloved hand steadying herself on the long server that had been our grandmother's, one skimming the backs of the chairs that lined the dining table, skimming our cheeks as well as she encountered us, one by one. Our father behind her, carrying her bag, saying, "Step aside," telling us, "Say good afternoon, say pardon me." Our father, the doorman's son, banging her two suitcases against the chair legs and setting the porcelain in the china cabinet ringing. This was in the drafty house in Hempstead where we grew up. It was an old house, red-shingled and white-trimmed, plagued with an endless series of tumble-down catastrophes that made our father in midlife a caricature of the hapless, city-bred, suburban homeowner. We recall him prowling through the rooms with a stepladder on his shoulder, with a hammer or a socket wrench in his hands. Our mother, when she was well, always smiling indulgently, following him with her eyes. The old Hempstead house. We recall the battered glass knob of the side door, our shoulders to its peeling paint, a nest of boots and shoes inside, no matter the season, a tattered rag rug, the dark basement breath of heating oil and cinder block and cold dirt. Then the three steps up to the narrow kitchen, dark green countertops, black linoleum floor flecked with red, red cabinets, appliances of enamel and steel, scent of clove and cinnamon and sunlight and dust, the narrow passage to the dining room, lace tablecloth, lace doilies, lace curtain at the window, and beyond it a continuation of lace, the apple tree in full wind-scattered bloom, or maybe a sudden shower of snow, as old Aunt Rose steadied herself, coming into the house, one gloved hand on the long server that had been our grandmother's, one running along our cheeks. Just where she had come from and why she had appeared remained uncertain. Upstate, we were told. Because she is old, we were told. She was given the guest room and directed by our father. We followed her halting journey up the stairs with our hands poised at her elbows or at her hips. She trembled, we recall, either because of her great age or because of her delight at our elaborate courtesies. The guest room on the third floor of the old Hempstead house was narrow beneath the eaves, painted yellow, white curtains at the window. Downstairs again, our father told the story of Great Aunt Rose and Red Whelan. Up in Poughkeepsie, this was, he said, just after the Civil War. A knock at the door when the family was at dinner, Rose only a small child, a man invited in, red hair, red skin, scattered red flesh from neck to ear as if a plow had scraped his face, one leg and one arm, so that he, too, Red Whelan, made a halting climb to the upstairs room, tap of crutch on each stair tread on the attic's bare wood. Patrick, our great-grandfather, a young schoolteacher by then, standing silently in the room's narrow doorway as Red Whelan was shown the bed, the washstand, a small desk and a wide wing chair, all the family had done to prepare the place for him, the room where he would live out his days. And Great Aunt Rose, still a child, holding his dinner in a covered dish. When we were teenagers, brooding in our bedrooms, brooding or hungover or just sleeping through an afternoon, as our mother used to do, our father would complain, his voice annoyed, bordering on angry, but amused also because he too had been a reader, a brooder, and the phrase had been his own father's refrain, hibernating up there like Red Whelan. Any red-headed, fat-faced, freckled Irishman was a regular Red Whelan. any house guest who stayed too long was threatening to become a Red Whelan. Any mention of old Aunt Rose's long and lonely life included the 40-odd years she had devoted herself to Red Whelan, her brother's substitute in the Civil War, a widowed spinster, our father called her, a married nun. We carried the tea things upstairs. We carried her sparse dinner, only small bowls of mush, soups and applesauce, and creamed farina. In the third floor room, she blinked at us from her bed or from her chair, her face always dusted with powder, although it seemed to us then that she was dusted with dust. And the little nursing sisters of the sick poor standing by. "Aren't you good?" they told us when we brought in the old lady's tray or took it away, Sister Jean among them, our favorite. We knew them well, the little nursing sisters, the order of nuns our mother had thought to join until, our father liked to say, she thought better of it. We knew them from our own fevered mornings, waking to find their pale hands to our foreheads and to our cheeks, or seeing through our crusted eyes their serious faces within the white bonnets as they put a thermometer between our lips, commanded us not to bite it. We watched them float around our sick beds, tugging and pulling with their short, clean hands until our night-tangled blankets and sheets were transformed into something clean again and cool. We knew them from all the long afternoons when we came home from school, hand to the glass knob of the battered side door, and found a nursing nun standing like a black and white beacon in the kitchen, her finger to her lips because our mother had once more taken to her shaded room to sleep off what they called her melancholy. They arrived by taxi in those days before their habits were amended to allow them enough peripheral vision to drive themselves. Our father scurried out to the curb to pay the fare. For years, we believed we were not unusual in this. For years, we believed the little nursing sisters of the sick poor, congregation of Mary before the cross, appeared in every household whenever crisis or illness disrupted the routine, whenever a substitute was needed for she who could not be replaced. So that's the Civil War part of the novel. As I was thinking about this whole notion of selflessness and self-sacrifice and one life substituted for another, and was trying to find a way into a story that could confront these things, I suppose I took to heart another great woman who writes, Emily Dickinson's injunction about telling all the truth but tell it slant. And so I thought about, well, so there is selflessness and there is selfishness. How would you dramatize selfishness? If selflessness is giving of one's life so that someone else might live, could you, metaphorically speaking, say someone who takes their own life with no regard for those who might live would define selfishness? And I ended up opening the novel. I had the paternal, pretty much the paternal genealogy down from Red Whelan and the substitute to the voice of the current 21st generation. So now I had to figure out what the maternal side of it was. And on the maternal side, I thought I need a character who, in complete selfishness, says, I don't want to go on. I'm taking my own life as proof that it is my own. And I imagined a young Irish immigrant who takes his own life out of that sense of stubbornness and selfishness and leaves behind, again, with complete disregard, a young wife who is expecting their first child, new immigrants at a time early in the 20th century when there wasn't much of a social safety net. And as I imagined him, along came early on the substitute. And I'll just give the I'll give you a sense of her appearance. This is in the aftermath of the suicide. He turns on the gas in their tenement apartment. And the odd thing is, when I was doing, I write the book and then I do the research. I know you're not supposed to do it that way, completely backwards. But research is so seductive that you can spend hours and days and months and weeks doing research and being on the internet and interviewing people and feeling like I'm such a writer. Oh, you know, I'm a real writer. I'm almost a journalist. I'm doing so much research. And then you realize I haven't written a sentence in weeks and months. So I like to learn the story and learn who the characters are and then do the research. And it was only after I wrote this that in doing research, I was reading a lot of newspapers from the early part of the 20th century, the 1910s and teens. And I was amazed to see how many reports there were of suicides via gas, via turning on the gas. And, well, obviously, people didn't have as many guns in New York as as they might have. That was the most ready to hand. They certainly didn't have as many sleeping pills. So that was the most ready to hand means of suicide. So I got it right. So this is in the aftermath of the suicide. He's sent his wife out to do her shopping, sealed up the apartment, turned on the gas. And when the wife comes back, he's pushed the couch in front of the door. She can't get in. She gets some neighbors to help out, and one very helpful neighbor lights a match. This is a book that, with some frustration, I don't usually read my reviews, but my husband and my editor sometimes will read out, even if I don't want to hear it. My husband especially will follow me around the house saying, no, you should really hear this. And I was sort of surprised that even with this book, I'm often called a quiet novelist, you know. And I thought, I started the damn book with a suicide and an explosion, and you're still calling me a quiet novelist. What do I have to do? At six, the street lamps against the wet dark gave a polish to the air. There was the polish of lamplight, too, on streetcar tracks and window panes and across the gleaming surface of the scattered black puddles in the street. Reflection of lamplight as well on the rump of the remaining fire truck and on the pale faces of the gathered crowd, with an extra gold sparkle and glint on anyone among them who wore glasses. Sister Saint Savior, for instance, a little nursing sister of the sick poor, who had spent the afternoon in the vestibule of the Woolworths at Borough Hall, her alms basket in her lap. She was now on her way back to the convent, her bladder full, her ankles swollen, her round glasses turned toward the lamplight and the terrible scent of doused fire on the winter air. The pouch with the money she had collected today was tied to her belt. The small basket she used was tucked under her cloak and under her arm. The house where the fire had been looked startled. The windows of all four floors were wide open, shade cords and thin curtains flailing in the cold air. Although the rest of the building was dark, the vestibule at the top of the stone stoop was weirdly lit, crowded with policemen and firemen carrying lamps. The front door was opened, as it appeared was the door to the apartment on the parlor floor. Sister Saint Savior wanted only to walk on, to get to her own convent, her own room, her own toilet. Her fingers were cold and her ankles were swollen and her thin basket was crushed awkwardly under her arm. But still, she brushed through the crowd and climbed the steps. There was a limp fire hose running along the shadowy base of the stone banister. Two of the officers in the hallway, turning to see her, tipped their hats and then put out their hands as if she had been summoned. "Sister," one of them said. He was flushed and perspiring, and even in the dull light, she could see that the cuffs of his jacket were singed, right in here. The apartment was crowded with people, perhaps every tenant in the place. The smell of smoke and wet ash, burned wool, burned hair, was part and parcel of the thick pools of candlelight in the room and of the heavy drone of whispered conversation. There were two groups. One was gathered around a middle-aged man in shirt sleeves and carpet slippers who was sitting in a chair by the window, his face in his hands. The other, across the room, hovered beside a woman stretched out on a dark couch under a fringed lamp that was not lit. She had a cloth applied to her head, but she seemed to be speaking sensibly to the thin young man who leaned over her. When she saw the nun, the woman raised a limp hand and said, "She's in the bedroom, sister." Her arm from wrist to elbow was glistening with a shiny salve. Butter, perhaps. "You might leave off with that grease," sister said, "unless you're determined to be basted." The young man turned at this, laughing. He wore a gray fedora and had a milk tooth in his grin. "Have the courtesy to doff your hat," she told him. It was Sister St. Saviour's vocation to enter the homes of strangers, mostly the sick and the elderly, to breeze into their apartments and to sail comfortably through their rooms, to open their linen closets or china cabinets or bureau drawers, to peer into their toilets or the soiled handkerchiefs clutched in their hands. But the frequency with which she inserted herself into the homes of strangers had not diminished over the years her initial impulse to stand back, to shade her eyes. She dipped her head as she passed through the parlor into a narrow corridor, but she saw enough to conclude that a Jewish woman lived here. The woman on the couch, she was certain, a Jewish woman, she only guessed, because of the fringed lampshade, the upright piano against the far wall, the dark oil paintings in the narrow hallway that seemed to depict two ordinary peasants, not saints. A place unprepared for visitors, arrested as things so often were by crisis and tragedy in the midst of what should have been a private hour. She saw as she passed by that there was a plate on the small table in the tiny kitchen that it contained a half piece of bread, well bitten and stained with a dark gravy, a glass of tea on the edge of a folded newspaper. In the candlelit bedroom, where two more policemen were conferring in the far corner, there were black stockings hung over the back of a chair, a mess of hairbrushes and handkerchiefs on the low dresser, a gray corset on the threadbare carpet at the foot of the bed. There was a girl on the bed, sideways, her dark skirt spread around her as if she had fallen there from some height. Her back was to the room and her face to the wall. Another woman leaned over her, a hand on the girl's shoulder. The policeman nodded to see the nun, and the shorter one took off his cap as he moved toward her. He, too, was singed about the cuffs. He had a heavy face, stale breath, and bad dentures, but there was compassion in the way he gestured with his short arms toward the girl on the bed, toward the ceiling and the upstairs apartment where the fire had been, a compassion that seemed to weigh down his limbs. "Soft-hearted," sister thought. "One of us." The girl, he said, had come in from her shopping and found the door to her place blocked from the inside. She went to her neighbors, the man next door and the woman who lived here. They helped her push the door open, and then the man lit a match to hold against the darkness. There was an explosion. Luckily, the policeman said, he himself was just at the corner and was able to put the fire out while neighbors carried the three of them down here. Inside, in the bedroom, he found a young man on the bed, asphyxiated, the girl's husband. Sister St. Saviour drew in her breath, blessed herself. "He fell asleep, poor man," she said softly. "The pilot light might have gone out." The officer glanced over his shoulder toward the bed and then took the sister's elbow. He walked her out to the narrow hall. Now they stood in the kitchen doorway, the arrested tableau, the bitten bread, the dark gravy, the glass of reddish tea on a small wooden table, the chair pushed back. There had been an urgent knock on the door, the newspaper with its crooked lines of black ink. "He killed himself," the officer whispered, his breath sour, as if in reaction to the situation he was obliged to report, turned on the gas. Lucky he didn't take everyone else with him. Accustomed as she was to breezing into the lives of strangers, Sister accepted the information with only a discreet nod, but in the space of it, in the time it took her merely to turn her cheek and bow her head, her eyes disappeared behind the stiff edge of her bonnet. When she looked up again, her eyes behind the glasses were small and brown and caught the little bit of light the way only a hard surface could, marble or black tin, nothing watery. The truth of the suicide was both acknowledged and put away. She had pried handkerchiefs from the tight fix of young women, opened them to see the blood mixed with phlegm, and then balled them up again, nodding in just such a way. She had breezed into the homes of strangers and seen the bottles in the bin, the poor contents of a cupboard, the bruise in a hidden place, seen as well once a pale, thumb-sized infant in a basin filled with blood, and saying nothing at all, had bowed her head and nodded in just such a way. "What's the girl's name?" she asked. The officer frowned. "Mick something. Annie, they called her. Irish extraction," he added. "That's why I thought to call for you." Sister smiled. Those button eyes had dark depths. "Is that so?" she said. They both knew no one had called for her. She had been on her way home, merely passing by. She dipped her head again, forgiving him his vanity. Didn't he say, too, that he had put out the fire himself? "I'll go to her then," she said. As she stepped away, she saw the milk-toothed young man, still in his hat, approach the officer. "Hey, O'Neill," he shouted, no courtesy in him. Inside the shadowed bedroom, the neighbor woman who stood at the bedside had her eyes elsewhere, at the gloaming at the far side of the cluttered room. She was a stout woman, about 40. No doubt there were children waiting to be put to bed, a husband to be placated. A woman with a family of her own, with troubles of her own, could not be expected to attend to the sorrows of another indefinitely. The nun only nodded as the two exchanged places. Thank you. Substitutes. Suzanne?
I'm going to take this opportunity to ask Alice a few questions myself. I've been dying to do this. And then we'll take questions from the audience. And at the end of that time, we'll move over to the visitor center, the Education and Visitor Center, where Lemuria will be selling, Jean, if I got this right, I think I dropped the note you gave me, where Lemuria will be selling books. And Alice will be glad to sign books if you would like to do that. And we'll have some wine and some refreshments and a good visit, talk about the fiction of Alice MacDermott.
You dropped all your notes.
I've been instructed to say a few things, and I've lost them all here.
We thought it might be a little warmer if we moved Alice and Lemuria over to the Education and Visitor Center, too.
So are we squared away now?
Squared away.
Okay, good. All right, well, let me start by asking a question about the Ninth Hour, because we've had some spirited discussions of the Ninth Hour here at the Welty House and in our book group. And so I want to focus on a key scene in the novel. And I'll begin by saying that Eudora Welty was a great reader of murder mysteries, and elements of mystery of the mystery genre recur in her fiction, though her fiction lacks the kind of resolution that you typically find in a mystery. And I was surprised then when I began reading The Ninth Hour that, in a sense, it is a kind of murder mystery. And there are clues that the reader needs to follow. So I wonder if you might talk about the role that the death of Mrs. Costello plays in the novel, and whether you're leaving her death a mystery in any way, or is this a mystery that's resolved in the course of the novel?
Well, that's the third element that I yell about when they say quiet fiction. I've got a suicide, an explosion, and a murder. And I'm still a quiet writer. Thank you, Suzanne. Well, not to give too much away, but I think maybe the clue is that something of what I was indicating before, that the novel is a memory piece in so many ways. The narrative is really filtered through the perceptions of a 21st century generation, sort of a gathering of anecdote and evidence and the use of imagination. In some ways, what I've done is I've flipped the whole notion of a flashback novel. We're all familiar with novels that open with an old lady or an old man staring through a window, usually it's raining, and then here he is at 17, here he is at 18. So what I've done is sort of just kind of flip that. The flashback is more vivid, and it only is really towards the end of the novel that you have a good sense of who's actually telling this story. So that's an element of some of the mystery, because there is never just one way to tell a story. And memory is indeed a confluence of events that happened, other people's versions of those events, the way we want to remember, the things we've forgotten, and the spin we want to put on it, and also a lot of fictionalizing. So the final gesture of the possibility that one character has purposely killed or allowed to die another character is really up to the reader to interpret.
I'm so thrilled you said that, because it keeps me from being unmasked in front of my reading cohorts. Let me ask one other question about The Ninth Hour, and then we'll talk some fiction more generally. I loved the way you handled point of view with the children, Sally and Patrick's children, being the narrators. But I think that was a big risk that you took.
Oh, yeah.
I think it's a risk that paid off wonderfully. I think it's really crucial to the novel. Could you talk about making that decision, which is an unconventional one?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think they're... You know, I would like to say, like, that I'm very courageous, you know, and that that I claimed that I will do this and to hell with everyone. But I've found that stories do indeed take on lives of their own. And I know Eudora has written about that, how characters, getting to a point where you can't say this character arose out of anything that happened. And that was very much the case with this voice. It was the only way for me to understand this story. And it was there from the beginning. And I knew I could get in a lot of trouble for it. And I was not courageous about it. I lost sleep over it. I was sick about it, actually, before it came out, because I knew it was it was not a conventional way of telling the story, and that it probably asks a little bit of the reader. And I've always felt that readers and writers should be collaborators in some way. I've never felt that the writer knows all and hands the work to the reader. I mean, the marvelous thing about being a reader and it's also one of the marvelous things about being a writer, is the intimacy of it. You know, a reader lends his or her inner voice, that voice with which we speak to ourselves, which is never the voice exactly that we use to anyone in our lives, even the people we love. That inner voice is what a reader lends to a writer in the process of reading. And a writer doesn't exist unless a reader has lent that voice. We can fill up pages and pages and pages with little marks, but unless a reader lends us that inner voice. And so it's this quiet conversation. I mean, it really is a collaboration. And so I've always felt that that writer and reader should be working on this together. And if writing is hard for me, well then, reader, reading might be a little hard for you too. You know, let's get at this together. I don't have answers that I want to give you. I want both of us to consider this world, this life, this particular story together. So I just had to trust that readers who are generous enough to lend me their inner voices will be generous enough to patiently wade through a story that may be told in an unusual way.
And the voice is for the narrator, the past has become more vivid than the present, and so that they sort of fade out and then come back in is that sort of the strategy there?
Yeah, and you know, I discovered because I did. There is this sense of inevitability, you know, that I have to tell the story this way, and I may get in a lot of trouble for it. But this story has to be told. It's inevitable, and I have to tell this story. Just like it's going to be about Irish Catholics again, I can't do anything about it. It's inevitable. I got to do it. It's my obligation. But I realized as I was working with this voice that in some ways, it's a parallel to what it is to be a person of faith. Because if you have faith, I mean religious faith, the past, what you have never seen, belief in things unseen, has more import and is steadier and ultimately defines your life in a more sweeping way than anything you experience. So for the person of faith, and when I realized I was writing a novel with lots of nuns in it, so they were all people of faith, for the person of faith, there is a vividness and something vivid and compelling about a past that they have never experienced. And so I wanted that sense of that there is a real energy to the narrative sections that are only imagination, and this is how faith comes: imagination, story, research, reading, and that forms a kind of belief that has more power and more endurance than anything that we do over the course of a single day.
Thank you. Yeah. I want to read a quotation from Eudora Welty about fiction, and because it seems to me that it also describes what you're doing in fiction. And then I'll give up the questions and let the audience ask a few. But Eudora has written this: "The writer must accurately choose, combine, superimpose upon, blot out, shake up, alter the outside world for one absolute purpose, the good of his story. To do this, he is always seeing double, two pictures at once in his frame, his and the world's, a fact that he constantly comprehends, and he works best in a state of constant and subtle and unfooled reference between the two. It is his clear intention, his passion, I should say, to make the reader see only one of the pictures, the author's, under the pleasing illusion that it is the world's." Does this statement describe some of what you're doing as a writer?
Yes, I love that, it really is. This is sort of a busman's. I mean, that's the kind of stuff writers don't really want readers to think about, you know, like just accept the world. Let's enter this world together. But in the composition, yeah, there is that sense. But it is, and this is why I'm a fiction writer, and why fiction is what I always prefer to read, because in fiction, since everything is a choice. And since any world, even if it seems to align with the real world, is a created world, because it's all about the language that the writer chooses. And so every sentence, every line, every detail not only allows the reader to see, as Eudora does, and as Conrad said, we must, but there's also meaning behind it, that is the author's hand. You never want that to show, but the challenge is that if I'm going to make this stuff up, you're going to have access to an understanding why. If I'm going to choose this detail rather than another, if I'm going to choose this world rather than another, then you, the reader, have every right to say, why? What's the other meaning? In life, we can't say that. Journalists never have to say that. They just have to say, this happened. And then they can walk away. The fiction writer says, this didn't really happen, but it happened. And the reader has to have access to understanding why, in the breadth of the story or the novel, this is so and something else is not.
Are there questions from the audience?
Oh, here's one over here.
I think Elise had one right there. Let me just introduce Elise Smith to Alice. Elise Smith is the mother of Katie Simpson Smith, a wonderful novelist herself.
Yes, yes. Right. You have my sympathies as the mother of a novelist.
Thank you, and thank you for that powerful, not quiet reading that you did.
Thank you.
So I am much struck by the way that you moved back and forth between larger conceptual issues and those gorgeous sentences that you read for us. And I'm wondering if you could talk a bit about both your first draft, what a first draft looks like, and also what the revision process is like. Do you start with larger issues and then only come back to sentence level writing and editing later on? Or are you really focused on the sentence and you spend a lot of time with that sentence even at the very beginning?
Thank you. Yes, that's it. The sentence first. I never know what draft I'm on. I think it was Gail Godwin who talks about printing out second drafts on yellow paper and third drafts. I admire that tremendously. What an organized mind. I never know what draft I'm on. And for me, it's always the sentence. I have to hear the voice. One of the wonderful, wonderful things that Eudora says that that I have taken so to heart is that she doesn't put it quite this way, but you know you're cooking when you can hear the sound of the next sentence before you know what the words are. That is so important. I mean, I have to be there. Story can't come first, or even if it does, it's way out there. For me, it's I have to hear the language. I have to be in the world. So I'm constantly revising. I revise all the time, and every morning when I get back to my desk, I revise everything that I wrote the day before, add a little more, and then revise and revise. So my process is it's sloppy, and confused. But on days that I'm discouraged about how it starts to feel like a slog, I like to tell myself it's an incantation. That if you work at it hard enough, and if you just get the right words in the right order, and if you go over it again and again and change slightly, the incantation will call in. Suddenly, the spirits will appear. But that's very important to me.
Yes, Sarah.
When asked if it got easier to write, I think she said something similar to, each book teaches me to write it as I'm writing it, kind mm-hmm. of something right. like that. But it occurred to me while you were talking about this intimacy between writer and reader, that perhaps as you get into maybe the fifth or the sixth or the seventh, that maybe you can anticipate, or that you have some more comfort with the idea that that will come in, just like you just talked about calling in the spirits mm-hmm. with this incantation. Do you find that it helps to have the idea of a reading public?
That's a wonderful question. Probably it does. I don't think it feels that way when you're elbow deep in a mess, you know, and you start thinking, I've never learned how to do this, or I used to know how to do this, but this story I don't know how to tell, or I can't get. But I do think there is a sense of trusting what you don't know. That's very hard to achieve when you're first starting out. It's one of the hardest things to teach young writers, to let go of your original intention. I have all kinds of metaphors that I use in class for it. You know, let go of the side of the pool. You know, and Seamus Heaney says in his Nobel Prize acceptance speech that poets must teach themselves to walk on air against their better judgment. And I think that is the that trusting that what you don't know will reveal itself to you if you work hard enough, and if you trust the language, and if you are after some kind of truth or authenticity, not to make a point or not to convince of anyone. And I think that's something, you know, sometimes it's still scary, but I think that sense of if you work hard enough and you grope in the dark long enough, the language will reveal the story to you. And that's a very, very difficult thing to learn, to trust when you're young, when you think, I better get the muse out of the way and take over here because she's really messing up, you know.
Other questions?
Hi.
When did you decide or discover that you wanted to be a writer, and how did that come about?
Well, that's a wonderful story because it's an Oswego story.
Yeah, I like this one.
And I've told this story many times, and not that repetition makes something true, but I've told it many times because it is true. I was in my second year at Oswego State, one of the colleges of the State University of New York, that I went to once because I had a Regents scholarship, and so the tuition was great. Two, because it was as far away from Long Island as I could get and still be in New York State. And three, because it had been named the number three party school that year by Playboy magazine.
Ole Miss has nothing on Oswego.
So that's why I was at Oswego, and I had no idea I was not a serious student. I thought I was going to major in sociology because they didn't have sociology in high school, and that sounded like something you would study in college. But I always loved to read and to write, and I took a class with Dr. Paul Briand, who was a retired Air Force colonel and a journalist, had written a biography of Amelia Earhart, and it was called The Nature of Nonfiction, and it was going to be personal essays, this was in the early 70s, and Dr. Briand was very into high tech at the time. So rather than make mimeograph copies of our work that we used to do in those, he called it dirty purple, to pass around, he would use the overhead projector and take your writing and put it up on a screen behind him. Yes, yeah, I mean, talk about be responsible for your sentences, and then correct it. You know, with a wax pencil, you know, with everybody. So the first assignment was an autobiographical essay of about 3 pages, and I went off to my dorm room and I wrote an autobiographical essay about something that never happened to me. a complete piece of fiction, but the narrator was someone who I could pretend I was. Dr. Breon put it up, and he read it out and did his God damn it, McDermott, and put commas in and things like that. And then it was over. He looked up and said, McDermott, I want to talk to you after class. So I thought, I'm caught, you know. Either that, he was going to send me for counseling. You did what? You know? So I sort of sheepishly walked to the front of the classroom as everybody else was leaving and heading for Buckland's, the bar. And he just looked up and he said, I have bad news for you, kid. You're a writer, and you'll never shake it. And it was, as I say, I tell this story all the time because it was a moment in my life that I suppose eventually I would have gotten there. But as soon as he said it, I knew it was true. And I knew I was just waiting for someone to say that to me. And I knew I was stuck with it. And that's what the best teachers can do, you know, open your mind to get you someplace where you probably would have gotten in a very circuitous way. And so I knew.
I think maybe we should call a halt. I want to say that thank God McDermott is a writer and that she's come here to spend the day with us. And I am so thrilled that my former student has made this wonderful life in writing for herself and for all of us. I hope you'll come to the visitor center, have a glass of wine, warm buy up. A book, and we'll see you there.
Thank you so much. Thank you.